Good morning.
That's kind of loud. Okay, we're ready to get started on this morning's Global Warming Environmental Justice Advisory Committee. And at the beginning of the meeting, as always, there are these important announcements and general housekeeping that we need to discuss. First is we have to talk about building evacuation and restroom information. In the event that the fire alarm goes off, please exit out the back door, proceed down the stairs, and out to Cesar Chavez Park, which is across the street, where you will wait for further instructions. Also, importantly, restrooms are located at the out the back exit, straight down the hall where you'll locate the restroom signs. I don't know entirely what that means, but I assume that you will be able to figure it out when you get out in the hall.
Right down this hall.
Go out into the hall, look for the bathrooms. They're not in here. In terms of oral and written comments, this is a public meeting, and we'll be taking oral and written comments from participants both in the room and participants who are online. If you plan to make an oral or written comment, we appreciate that if you would fill out a blue card, which they say is in the back of the room, but I see them here. Oh, it's out in the hallway. That just helps us with knowing how many people would like to make comments so that we can judge how long the public comment period should be, and it's very helpful. And any written comments that you make can be given to Johnny Raymond, who's our committee liaison, and your blue comment cards can also be given to Johnny. And I'd like to remind all the committee members that this meeting is also being webcast, and so please remember to speak into your microphones. And if there are people who are watching the webcast who would like to submit comments or questions to the committee, they can do that at onair, all one word, at arb.ca.gov. So with that, we are going to, I should talk about the agenda. So on our agenda for today, we had planned to go from 10 until 1 and discuss early action measures this morning, which we will do, have a public comment on those early action measures, and then we were going to discuss the Market Advisory Committee's report. Unfortunately, the Market Advisory Committee has changed its plans and will be releasing its report on June 1st. That would be someday after today, making it difficult for us to review, discuss, and develop recommendations on the report. And in talking with the staff person that works with the market Advisory Committee, their belief was that because the report wasn't yet public, that it wouldn't be appropriate to discuss the contents of the report with the committee today. So we won't have a representative from the Market Advisory Committee to talk about the contents of that report or their recommendations going forward, which is unfortunate. And we may have comment upon that later anyway. After that. So that item has been, as of yesterday, removed from the agenda.
Was it just tabled till next meeting?
So it's tabled till next meeting.
But if some of us had some things we'd like to share about that, maybe we could leave it on the agenda because, you know, this is our meeting, and yes, if they don't give it to us, we have some things, then we'll just say.
Yes, I think that would
so
be perfectly
appropriate.
So I would
ask you not to remove it from the agenda.
I'm sorry. So it hasn't been removed from the agenda. It will not be a review and discussion and development of recommendations because we don't have the report, but we are still free to comment upon Market Advisory Committee activity.
Yeah.
And we can have a robust conversation, I'm sure, about that. Followed up by a general public comment period in case there are others who would like to have robust conversation about the non-report. And then we'll talk about next steps, and we will close the meeting. Are there any other committee members that wanted to make any comments? No. Okay. We have, we had on our website and we have outside of the room and on the table the committee's proposed recommendations, the draft version, the committee's proposed recommendations, and we're going to talk about that now. I'd like to have my presentation up on the screen. Got this amazing fancy technology. Wanted to give a brief overview for the public and for the committee, summarizing where we are now and the outcome of our previous work on this item. ARB was instructed in AB 32 to develop a set of early action measures. In particular, they're supposed to submit a list by June 20th. The staff is supposed to submit a list by June 30th to the board. The board is going to be having a meeting on June 21st and 22nd, which they will receive the staff's report and adopt a list of proposed early action items. Just by way of background, on April 20th of this year, the CARB staff released the report for proposed early action measures, which included three groups of proposed measures. Group one contained three measures, group two contained 23 measures, and group three contained 10 measures. This committee at our last meeting formed a subcommittee, and the subcommittee met, as did the full committee, reviewed ARB's report, and reviewed all the materials that we received in response to the request that's noted. That's an excerpt from the email message that I sent requesting the information. And in particular, we noted that we had been approached by several stakeholders indicating that they believed they'd submitted letters or made oral suggestions for things to be included in the list of proposed early action measures, and they weren't reflected in the report. So we asked to see all the letters and records of public comments that ARB used in developing the proposed early action measures, and we reviewed all that information. The committee met on May 17th, the subcommittee met on May 17th, and the full committee met on May 23rd to discuss our recommendations. In discussing our recommendations, we had several criteria that we applied to the measures that were found in ARB's April 20th report. The first was that, is the measure technologically feasible? The second criteria that we applied was, does the measure cause increases in criteria or air toxics emissions, also called backsliding? We evaluated whether or not there would be co-pollutant reduction benefits from the measure. And does the measure have a disproportionate positive or negative impact on communities already facing unacceptably high environmental burdens? So we applied each of these criteria to all of the measures that were in ARB's report. Essentially, the committee made various different categories of recommendations. There were those items that we recommended for early action. There were those measures that ARB did not supply the committee with sufficient information to formulate a recommendation on the measure. There were measures that we agreed with CARB were not early action measures, but we believe they should be proposed or developed as measures for addressing greenhouse gas emissions. There were two measures that the committee recommended be removed from the early action list. There were two measures that the committee agreed were non-regulatory and supported that action. There were a couple of measures that were sort of miscellaneous. There was one that we expressed support for, a voluntary program that's currently being implemented around ag engines. And there was one measure about which we raised some possible concerns, and that was the measure about a forestry protocol. And all of our comments and encapsulation of the discussion that we had around each of these measures is included in the chart that was outside the room and is also available on the website. And there was one measure, it turned out, when I was putting together this presentation, which was uncategorized. We skipped one in our conversations, which was a specification for commercial refrigeration, so we should talk about that. I'm not sure if we have a letter on that in our package or not.
Is that the CRU one or the one on changing the HCFCs?
Commercial refrigeration is item number 3.3. So that's a very, very tiny version of our list of recommendations, and essentially every single one of these recommendations came out of the staff's report. However, there were two where I attempted to capture the conversation that the subcommittee had that wasn't on the draft list that you have before you and is on the web. And there were three entirely that, I mean, I'm sorry, there were three that were added that were not included in the report. Because I think that there's the most interest about the committee's recommendations for those items that we recommended be removed from the list. I thought that I would just go over quickly summarizing the conversation that we had, and certainly if there are members who'd like to add more as I talk about this, you should feel free to do so. The two measures that we recommended for removing from the early action measures list was the low carbon fuel standard and the reduction of HFCs from what they call non-professional servicing or small cans. On the low carbon fuel standard, essentially the proposal by CARB was that develop a carbon intensity standard for California's vehicle fuel, which would reduce by at least 10% the carbon emissions by 2020. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what is a carbon fuel standard. On May 20th, two professors at the UCs, one at UC Berkeley and one at UC Davis, released a technical analysis that was commissioned by CARB they talked about what is a fuel intensity standard, and I just wanted to highlight the fact that there's a difference between a fuel intensity standard and an absolute reduction. A 10% reduction in carbon intensity would result in an absolute increase of 13% of greenhouse gases related to transportation fuels. If we were seeking to have an absolute reduction in emissions, that would require actually a fuel intensity reduction of 31% by 2020. So a fuel intensity standard is not the same thing as an absolute reduction. And so what does that mean? I think that what that means is this is not a reduction below the 1990 baseline. And so that number that's highlighted by CARB in their report of 10 to 20 million metric tons of CO2 equivalent reductions is not from the 1990 baseline, but is in fact from the business as usual standard that they expect would exist in 2020. And while we're not actually getting real reductions in carbon emissions, there are possible impacts from the low carbon fuel standard. We noted in particular in our recommendations a report that was released by the UN in which they highlighted that biofuels have great potential. However, the benefits may be undone by serious environmental problems and higher food prices. And the committee expressed, each of the committee members, I think, expressed lots of concerns about the potential environmental problems and the higher food prices. And we were concerned that by moving forward with this as an early action measure, as compared to waiting for more overall development and infrastructure, that there would be serious negative impacts that would be problematic. We see this happening right now. This is a report from the Washington Post talking about increase in corn prices and its impact in Mexico in terms of food security, and it's actually causing protest and additional problems in that part of the world. We're also concerned, and we noted in particular in our report, that ethanol may pose significant risk to human health and may also have backsliding issues based upon a report that was released by Mark Jacobson, who's a professor at Stanford University, in his recent analysis of using ethanol as in fuel. The second measure that we talked about removing is the reduction of HFCs from the non-professional servicing of cars. And we recommended in its place that ARB undertake a broader review of possible HFC reductions. We recognize that HFC is an important global warming gas and has a very high carbon equivalent impact on the environment. However, we believe that there are lots of opportunities for reducing HFCs, including removing refrigerants from decommissioned cargo containers, removing HFCs from commercial and residential air conditioning systems, removing HFCs from autos before they are crushed or dismantled, and we believe that there are potentially much higher reductions available from those kinds of controls, and that they would avoid the regressive impacts of the HFC, the current proposed HFC reduction plan. The committee discussed and came to consensus around the idea that under the current proposal, it would be people who are lower income, people of color, who tend to do home repairs, who would be disproportionately negatively impacted by taking those small cans off the market. And we also commented that the detection repair of leaking auto systems is an important thing. However, this small can ban didn't seem to really advance that objective. And then briefly, I wanted to comment upon, I've listed five, but there's actually three proposed measures that we added. These are measures that were not included in the CARB's report, but CARB did receive letters from the public about these measures, outlining them and their potential impacts. And we discussed and recommended that these be included in the list of early action measures. And I should also note that the committee discussed that we believe that it'd be important to start with a more robust list of proposed early action measures, so that way if through the rule development process, if there turns out that there are one or two that can't be met, but that can't meet the timeline, that there are technical problems that arise during the development, there are other issues that arise, that we don't reach the end of the early action adoption period and find that we've got no measures left or one measure left, thereby getting very few early reductions through the early action measures program. So the committee is recommending a more robust list with the recognition that some of those things may not actually be completed by the 2010 deadline, but better to be closer to the 2010 deadline than have deferred many of those items to the scoping plan or to have not started the work on that rulemaking process. And then there were some general comments. AB 32 indicated that this process should be an open and public process. And the public and this committee should have access to complete information so that we can make our own determinations about the reasonableness and the completeness of the policies that were crafted to meet the recommendations. We noted in our recommendations that there were several items that were included in the ARB's report about which we received no information. So it's unclear to us what those items were, what was proposed by either the staff or the public, and whether or not that's something that appropriately should be on the early actions measure list. We also, as I noted before, were contacted by several people, including several committee members who reported that they submitted letters, they gave oral testimony, those weren't incorporated in the report. And so that raised questions about the robustness of the ARB's process, both in terms of reviewing the comments that came in written from people and in terms of capturing and reporting back on oral comments. It appeared, based upon conversation that I had with staff at ARB, that there was not a method to actually track oral comments that were submitted during public comment periods to the ARB at the early action meetings, which is particularly problematic from the context of the communities that this committee is supposed to be working with, because many members of our communities come to public testimony and give testimony orally and don't provide written letters. And if there isn't a way to routinely and reliably collect those public comments to review them later to ensure that those comments are understood and incorporated as appropriate, then that's particularly just going to impact the people that we work with and support.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, before you go forward on that particular point, you're indicating that there was no way to that it was stated that there was no way to track oral comments. What about the written comments that were made? What was the explanation in regard to that?
On the written comments, they gave to us all the written comments they have. And part of the difficulty is there are proposals that are incorporated in those written comments that weren't reflected in there, so that's a matter of how they read and incorporated those comments. And there were also issues, they said, about people submitting comments to various different agencies, and it was overall an unwieldy process. And so they did the best they could to collect up all the written comments and review those comments and incorporate them as seemed appropriate. Mm-hmm. The committee also discussed and wanted to comment upon the fact that we were unclear as to why some of the measures in Attachment B of ARB's report were afforded to the CAC committee. There's an attachment to the report that outlines a number of measures that were sent to other agencies outside of ARB. And it appeared to us that it may be the case that some of those measures would appropriately be under the jurisdiction of the Air Resources Board. However, because of the lack of information about what exactly those comments were and what exactly the proposed measures were, all we had to work with was the short description that was in the report. And so we weren't able to actually formulate a recommendation about many of those items. And then finally, the committee raised concerns about the serious lack of transparency in the process, particularly around the issues of access to information. We requested, however, my belief is it still has not occurred, that all the letters that were received by ARB as part of this early action process be posted to a website, and then members of the public could go and see for themselves whether their comments are there. And they also would be able to, if there were more clarity in the report that ARB outlined, they would be able to see if their comments were rolled in with another comment, appropriately characterized, and the like. However, that information is currently not available. Likewise, if there were more information about why things were sent to the CAC team, if there was more information about why things were deferred to the scoping process as compared to being put on any one of the three categories that are outlined in the ARB's report, then the public and this committee would be able to engage in a conversation with ARB about those issues as compared to what's happened in the process so far, which is there's been a lack of transparency, which makes it very difficult to comment upon the contents of the report. So that was my overall presentation summarizing what happened in the subcommittee reports and our conversations. And I'd like to open it up to other committee members to either add comments about the report or to talk about other recommendations. Laura.
Thanks, Angela. That was a great overview. And thanks to the subcommittee and the committee for all the hard work you did going through all of those materials. I know it was a lot, and I think you did a really excellent job and want to thank you for that. I strongly agree with your comments about making sure the early action items is a robust enough list, if you will, that if things fall off, and things will because that's the nature of it, that we have enough things that are on there that really can deliver on the promise that was made to the people of the state and to get these reductions. So there were a number of I thought, really, of course, we thought ours were very good, but other organizations that provided a lot of really excellent ideas that should be included in this list, and I'd like to add a few of those to recommendations that we make for early actions, and then if they are more appropriately should be on another list, it's as you say, they'll get moved as a matter of course. The first two that I would like to add for the committee's consideration, you have our letter, and again, Angela, thanks for the mini education I got this morning. So I have a revised recommendation for two of ours that I would like to put forward. And these are both related to aging power plants in the state, and I'm hopefully this whole letter issue I'd like to talk about separately because ours is off in the void somewhere, and I don't know who's seen it and who hasn't, if anybody. But there are, aging power plants constitute 22 million tons a year of CO2 and a lot of the particulate matter problems in our communities. So if we could get on track to getting rid of those and replacing them with something cleaner and better and more appropriate, that would be a big greenhouse gas win. It'd be a big co-pollutant win and a big co-community benefit win. And so I'd like to get those put on the list. The two that I would like to propose are that, one, CARB shall establish necessary rules and or emission thresholds for transmission to local air regulators to phase out aging power plants by 2010. Because I know that ARB doesn't have the direct regulatory authority, but they do rulemaking and they do establish thresholds and that kind of thing. So hopefully that would be acceptable to the committee. And then second, CARB shall establish rules to direct or result in prohibition of fuel oil burning by base load electric generating plants over 100 megawatts and built before 1980. If you look on the very last page of the letter I handed out to everybody, and there were copies for the public, maybe people can share, it's just essentially changing the beginning part to ask CARB to establish rules and or necessary thresholds to accomplish those two things. The third one I'll withdraw. That's more of a, I think goes in a different category. So I would ask for those two things. And I also was seeking, well, I know there's others that want to say, I have another one if we have time later. Thanks.
So why don't we have a conversation about Laura's proposed recommendations for the early action measure, and then we'll, I don't know if we should, I'll just say quickly that this letter was submitted to ARB. They have received this list, and like she said, we don't know who saw it and who hasn't seen it. And they also submitted testimony in oral at the early actions meeting that ARB held. So this is not something new that we're interjecting into the process. So we should talk about Laura's recommendation, and are there committee members that have comments upon her recommendation? Everyone has a letter. Does everyone understand the recommendation? I think I got to. So just for clarity, so I think that what you're asking us to review is on the back page, item number one, CARB shall establish
necessary rules and or emission thresholds for transmittal to local air regulators to phase out aging power plants by 2010. And we can fix that language up more if we want. Well, we're trying to get at those that are over 100 megawatts and built prior to 1980, because those are the ones polluting us the worst. And then hopefully in their infinite wisdom, they will choose to establish a carbon dioxide permit system.
We'll see. Bill?
No, I want to echo what Laura said about the overview and the process that this committee's tried to follow and taking very, very seriously our job as an advisory body, that the only body that's mandated to exist throughout the entire life of the legislation, which I think reflects the importance that environmental justice is to both the letter and the spirit of AB 32. I think we just need to emphasize that. I was actually, I guess maybe just saying it another way, I was very disappointed in the list that came from CARB. Just, it seemed to me that there was somewhat of an attitude of taking kind of somewhat a politically low-risk approach to this, and I think at the same time there seemed to be a lot more emphasis on kind of market mechanism kinds of work. So, I just in terms of what the signal was, it seemed to me we were getting very kind of mixed messages there. And I think the one of the difficulties, just I attended a lot of the subcommittee meeting where we discussed this, was not knowing what the basis for the methodologies and the evidence for the decisions that were made or things that were not considered. So that's what made the thing very difficult, and I think the committee did a remarkable job given just a lack of information on which to make a real informed decision. I want to support, and I think in light of trying to really help the state achieve its objectives, and in light, I think we were trying to be very rigorous in looking at the criteria that CARB had put forward and that the legislation mandates for choosing early action items. I think that the proposal from the Environmental Health Coalition fits all of that. So it's doable. It's within the purview of the agency. It's going to have significant reductions. It's cost effective. It does not have has an anti-backsliding effect because it's going to help low-income communities of color. So I think from that standpoint, I think it's really an important item to add. I just want to just editorialize a little bit or just add as a concern here is I know when we talked, when we looked at the staffing proposal for the legislation, there were only 5 staffers, I think, that were proposed for implementation of early action items. And I just want to say that if there is a robust list that's finally put forward, I think that's going to be insufficient staffing to really see this through in the way that we want, because what we don't want is kind of another adoption of measures that then never get implemented. So I want to just add that in there, is that I think we really need to take this in conjunction with the staffing proposal. But I want to echo that, and I think, you know, we have a lot of understanding because of our communities face a very similar situation with these kind of aging energy producers. Our focus is a little bit more on the refinery piece on this, but I think it seems to me that what Laura is proposing here fits very well within the scope of what should be an early action item.
Just 2 quick comments, Bill. First of all, I think that also AB 32 and the intent of the legislature as encapsulated in AB 32 clearly is seeking a way to address California's energy infrastructure. And we know that that there are large emissions that are associated with the energy infrastructure. And there's also a lot of ways to reduce those emissions, including moving from fossil fuel to clean renewable alternatives. And ultimately, if we want to get to our 2020 reduction goals, we're going to have to move away from fossil fuels into clean renewable alternatives. And so to the extent that we can prioritize the reductions of reliance upon aging infrastructure that negatively impacts not just our communities and our health, but also the planet, that's a good thing. And we should do that sooner rather than later. And then also I should note that the budget is being reviewed by the legislature right now, and there have been some discussions about enhancing the size of the early action team at ARB. So, other comments about the recommendation?
Excuse me, Madam Chair. I just have one clarifying question. Assuming that this measure was adopted, so how would that be actually implemented in terms of limiting the CO2 emissions from those plants? They would have to install the best available control technologies, or how would that occur?
Well, our thought, is mine on? Actually, with the old power plants, and these are the ones that are the dinosaurs that were built pre-1980, ours in our neighborhood is like over 60 years old at this point. Basically, we want them phased out because even if you put on the best emission technology, they're still hugely inefficient users of this diminishing fossil fuel resource. So in our perfect world, ARB would establish these rules saying this is what needs to happen. That would get handed down to the local air regulators who do issue air permits for these facilities. And then they would be on notice that they need to be phased out. In my letter, Henry, maybe I'll be a little more articulate than I'm being right now, but there's also there's this reliance that we're building up on these old power plants when the independent systems operator is looking to which plants are they going to keep alive, basically with very expensive contracts for reliability. And we need to kind of wean them off of these most problematic of facilities. So we actually don't, we're not seeking cleaner technology. We're seeking a controlled, quick phase out of these old facilities and forcing us to get right on the path that Angela was just talking about.
Okay, I understand what you're saying in terms of the eventual phase out, and I certainly support that. But I just received this letter here. So is that aspect of the recommendation included in the letter, or is that just addition or something that we would be seeking to happen in the final end but not specified in this recommendation?
The phase out is in the letter. What's different is that we had originally asked for ARB to establish an early action carbon dioxide permit system, which I think is not the right thing to ask ARB to do, but rather ask them to set the rules that then would require the local air districts who would basically do the permitting system. So the language and the specific action is a little different based on more information that I got today, but the arguments are still the same that are laid out, and the phase out is the goal, essentially, and that's in the letter. And I'm sorry you didn't have this earlier, and when we get to talking about how letters and information moves around, we'll want to address that.
Other members?
Well, I guess the issue I'm puzzling over is that we really need some sort of system not only for aging power plants but also for existing power plants, because we now have over 20 proposed new fossil fuel power plants for California. California is going to be more dependent on fossil fuel after this administration leaves office at any time in its previous history. And the volatility of natural gas has a huge impact on our communities as far as utility pricing, but the emissions of the PM2.5 especially, and all the whole suite of emissions are very, very concerning to me. So I guess I'm trying to grapple with the fact that, yeah, we've got the worst and dirtiest actors, and we should do something about them, but if we're going to talk about emissions from fossil fuel plants, from natural gas-fired power plants or coal-fired power plants in the state, I think we should kind of make a more general recommendation about that. I mean, we've got plants. I think in almost every person who's sitting at this table has a plant probably proposed within, 20 or 30 miles from the communities that they work in. And those plants, and even though it's clean power, so to speak, from fossil fuels, as one of our members says, it's the cleanest, dirtiest clean power around, right, because of the emissions are still very deadly. So I don't know, I just kind of throw that out there to puzzle. This is a, very, as people who may have been at the subcommittee meetings know, we actually spent a great deal of time on many of these measures, and this is a recommendation I feel like we need to spend a lot of time on. Because I would hate to say that we made some sort of recommendation or we spoke somehow just on the aging power plants and not on all the new existing ones that are planned for environmental justice communities across the state, as well as, the ones that are, Jesse just had a repower in Long Beach, and, other community members that are here have existing plants that are not pre-1980s but still have huge emission problems. So that's what I'm grappling with. So I invite someone else to solve the problem that I put out there, because I'm still working on the commercial refrigerant debacle.
Angela? Well, one of the things we might want to consider is there was a whole suite of early action measures that were proposed to the Climate Action Team, which is made up of a lot of agencies outside the jurisdictional purview of CARB. Within these early action measures, there are very general kind of items that they described with no real kind of meat to the bones. There's renewable power, better incentives for renewable energy, from net metering to solar compensation. And I think to some extent there needs to be a way to at least, yeah, marry those, or to actually get the climate action team to convey to us what their thoughts are in terms of implementing or follow-ups that they're going to pursue in response to CARB's recommendations. Particularly because some of these power plant issues are either happening through the CEC permitting process, or there are currently PUC processes dealing with procurement and power purchase agreements and yada, 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 as well as the implementation of existing renewable energy programs. It would be nice to know if, in fact, they're culminating in a way that is actually going to get us the deployment of technology and the emissions that has, up to this point, been promised. That is a huge conversation. A lot grander than just CARB, though CARB is an important piece of that. But I think we need to think about how best to harness those agencies and find a way to ensure that, in fact, there is some activity going on per these types of issues. And also maybe let us know what can CARB do and what can't CARB do and what needs to be done in order to get the ball moving and so forth.
I mean, that's because, you know, as I sit here and I think about if we were really looking at what were early actions, what are things that could be done in the next 2 to 3 years to get us off of the fossil fuel, you know, treadmill that we're on, and get us on to, you know, the whole suite of renewable energy that has huge impacts as far as emissions reductions and health benefits, but also job creation and economic development in the state. What does that switch look like? And what would we need to do now? What kind of recommendations do we need to do now to work on that? You know, taking a look at what, you know, what contracts need to be, you know, contracts for transmission lines. What kind of community process around transmission do we need to have? Because that's a huge problem. You've got people parachuting into communities and saying, I'm building a transmission line, and then people getting very upset about that and huge community impacts. And there's no process by which to approach communities on these transmission lines that we need. So, I mean, it's I think that if the committee really put its mind around it and the environmental justice impacts on energy production and transmission, that we could come up with not just an early action measure that would suit, you know, what Laura is talking about, but something that's a lot more comprehensive and would make a lot more sense and would provide some sort of visionary blueprint for what we can do in the short term, the next year, what we can do in the medium term, the 3 year, and what we can do in the 10 year term and the 20 year term.
Is there a way that we can craft a recommendation that focuses the attention on the older facilities as a first step to this broader vision? Because I agree completely that there are lots of issues around the current and proposed construction of fossil fuel power plants, and I know that we are working to address a suite of plants that are being proposed for the South Coast Air Basin right now, and it does seem that there's a gap between what's actually happening and the rhetoric about how we're going to address greenhouse gas emissions and what the plans are of the state and how we're moving forward on that. But it does also seem to me to be appropriate to focus initially on the worst emitters and have that as part of the stepping stone as we are transitioning from dirtier, particularly dirty, fossil fuel plants to clean renewable alternatives. So I don't know if there's a way that we can balance the two, or what the will of the committee is to construct two recommendations that are at the same point, or have one broad recommendation that's got a focusing clause in it. I don't really know how we want to do that, but
you know, if I could just suggest, I really agree with your comments. I would actually ask that we let the aging power plants is in the category of their own, and they have all, you know, the CEC has said they want them shut down. Everybody wants the things gone. So if we could let that move forward. But I think I agree with the comments that both of you and Jane have made, that you know, about energy, we need to get on a different track. About refineries, we need to get on a different track. About agriculture, we need to get on a different track. And the ports, too, you know, how we're moving goods through communities. I mean, those, to me, as I've been hearing the other groups, those are four areas that really need serious revamping and looking at. So maybe a way to do it, and I don't know if we can do it in time for, you know, June 21st or by 1 o'clock today or whatever, but maybe there's some focused meetings or subcommittees on those four categories to start with, because I think those four represent a lot of the issues I'm hearing that we all have, that our communities have, and that we do need to do that roadmap of, you know, what's the short-term plan, what's the next-term plan, and we need to give guidance to ARB about how they need to manage that. So maybe that's a way to, it's a little bit of a longer-term thing, but I think we need more focused attention on minimally those four categories.
Yes, I agree with that recommendation, that we set up sort of a series of thematic meetings and that we add the whole issue of economic development into that, so that we're, so with the four categories are energy production, transmission, refineries, ports,
agriculture, and economic development.
Okay. Yeah. No. Madam Chair, in regard to the recommendation, is there any reference to development of renewable energy once those old power plants are phased out? Because I'm concerned that if we pass the recommendation to the effect that's on the table, and said that, assuming that that did occur, and it being said that now we have a need for capacity, and so let's go with these nuclear power plants as the alternative, and I don't really think that that's a great idea. So I think that if we did support the recommendation on the table, that it should be some reference to the development of renewable energy and not just leave it open-ended.
If I'm not mistaken, I think CalPERS Secretary Lynn Adams has been anointed through an executive order to convene and coordinate all of the different agencies, particularly those of the climate action team. So at some point in the future, it might be good just to get a clarification on exactly how that coordination is going and what process they have on their way and how best we could interject into that.
Right, and we do have a general recommendation that's at the top of our chart that says, note that where electrification is recommended, the committee recommends renewable energies used as a power source. Yeah, I mean, it would be tragedy to say we're going to shut down, all these old power plants and we're going to hook into the Devers line and bring in clean coal from, wherever the other line, clean coal from Wyoming or something like that, or dirty coal from Wyoming. So, I mean, I think we have to be very mindful of the fact that, that coal is seen as a cheap form of energy, and that to the extent that we shut down older polluting facilities, we may end up with coal as the replacement. And so are we really just jumping from the fire into the frying pan as far as both emissions or greenhouse gases? So we have to make a recommendation that's global enough, right? Just like we did with electrification, these other measures. When we made these recommendations, we specifically talked about, I think it was the Martha Amendment, right? This renewable energy that we have a number of recommendations in here that talk about electrification. And it doesn't make any sense to electrify something if you're electrifying it with a nuclear power plant or a coal-fired power plant. So in general, I think we have to grapple with what that recommendation looks like so that we have that sort of general thing in there.
I guess it's, energy is tricky because, I'm playing the comments out or all make a lot of sense. And in my region, we have to be careful that we don't say, yes, we're going to replace it with renewable energy, and then they build the Sunrise Power Link, and it's really an easy hookup to, polluting plants in Mexico with this little green tinge on it a couple hours a day. So, I mean, this is the gnarliness of the electric grid, and I think, well, I'm all for I think the global thing is important. It also plays out differently in each local community, and how the GRETA operates and what your reliability constraints are and who's a cul-de-sac and who's a, you know, net energy generator. I mean, it's just a little bit more complicated. I wonder, though, just to respond to Henry's comment, if we could add maybe to establish the rules to phase out aging power plants and to enhance or incentivize clean renewable replacement, something like that. I mean, again, I'm trying to be sensitive to what can CARB do and what can't they do, certainly when we go talk with CEC and PUC about what they need to do, and we got to get on that because they're the ones that can really force the renewable, clean renewable energy in basin a lot better, but at least some language to add an acknowledgement that we're not asking to trade for a nuclear power plant in everyone's backyard. We're trying to get to a better solution here. Would that be acceptable, Henry, if I were to
add something like that? Yeah, it would be acceptable to me. Yeah.
Okay. I don't know what others think about that.
So do we have a... Oh.
No, I'll just wait.
So do we have a new recommendation, and are people prepared to have a recommendation on the table and call for a vote? Or do we want to have more conversation about that?
Well, it sounds like we have, to sum up, it sounds like we have two recommendations. We have a recommendation that responds directly to Environmental Health Coalition and the concerns around aging power plants. And then we have this broader recommendation that I really like. Laura, thank you so much for that contribution about looking at what's right in front of us now. You know, we've been, here's my binder, we've been looking through what's right in front of us now, but then what's in front of us in this longer term, and to implement these shifts in ag and transportation and refineries and power plants, what do we need to do? So I also would like us to think about that and develop, we don't have to do it right now, but before the meeting is over, develop, you know, how do we want to wrap our minds around that and our recommendations around that as well.
So can we get a motion?
I would move the two recommendations around aging power plants.
Any other conversation? All in favor of adopting the recommendation around the aging power plants?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the recommendation is adopted. And let me just double check with Martha, who's being our diligent note taker. You've got the...
aging power plants and encourage clean renewable energy. Second, we recommend the elimination of all
CARB shall establish necessary rules and or emission thresholds for transmission to local air regulators for the phase out of aging power plants by 2010. And methods to enhance and incentivize clean renewable energy replacements. And then the second one, when you're ready, is to establish rules to direct prohibition of fuel oil burning by base load electric generating plants over 100 megawatts and built before 1980.
Okay. So just for clarification, we recaptured Laura's proposal. I believe that was the proposal we thought that we were voting on, but I should just want to check to make sure if that changed anybody's view about whether they were supporting the recommendation. Okay. Bill, you had comments?
Yeah, I just, in kind of a light of our discussion, I wanted to suggest another early action item related to the refineries.
Okay.
And I think people have the language I'm referring to. On the language on page 2, the letter that we sent to CARB, specifically.
Actually, Bill, can I interrupt? Let me just clarify that this measure was before the subcommittee, and we requested more information from Committees for a Better Environment. and at our full committee at this meeting.
Okay.
So again, this is some, this is there were actually three of these measures, one of which we got information on and voted at the last meeting, which were ag measures, and then these two on power plants and refineries.
Okay.
Just for members of the audience who haven't, you know, they haven't been able to come to every meeting or watch every subcommittee okay. meeting and follow the thread. So this is basically Committees for a Better Environment submitted a letter to ARB. It was not in our record. It was not in our record. It was brought up at our subcommittee meeting. We requested more information, and now we have more information, and now Bill's going to present on this more information.
Thanks,
and we're
going
to make a recommendation
yes.
and vote on this.
Yeah,
so.
This was another one of these.
Another one of these.
Desaparecidos.
This, yeah, right, this category.
Okay. Thanks, Jane. Well, just maybe just for a little context, the recent energy audits have shown that there's feasible and effective measures to achieve greater energy efficiency in oil refineries, which would reduce emissions and save quite a bit of resources. Energy efficiency can result in significant reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, criteria pollutions, and toxics, and refineries are the single largest energy-consuming industry in California. The CEC recently estimated oil refinery CO2 equivalent emissions at about 10% of the state's total. Many processes at refineries can become more efficient through readily available technologies, and as evidence of this feasibility, a major oil refinery recently declared a goal of 10% reduction in energy use by 2012. This goal and the technologies available for achieving it could translate to a 15 to 20% reduction from business as usual for 2020. If the refinery sector as a whole achieved this goal, it would reduce greenhouse gases by 9 to 12 million megatons. So the specific language is being recommended is oil refinery energy efficiency and alternative audit to reduce CO2 and methane. Refinery energy audits and recommendations implementations, including but not limited to recycling, quote, waste gases instead of dumping or incinerating. Two, removal of methane exemptions from air pollution regulations. That should be a no-brainer. And three, evaluation of alternative energy for refinery electricity consumption. Impact of heavier crude oil modifications, which is the trend in the industry, on greenhouse gas emissions and other energy efficiency measures. So, Henry, I just want to make sure that we did try to include the alternative energy piece in here to make sure that that didn't kind of fall through the cracks. So that's basically the language. We had originally suggested, I think, several other items, but we decided to focus on this one as one that would clearly fall within the range of early action measures. Thanks, Angela.
Any comments from the other members?
So, Bill, your letter talks about the significant reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, and I'm going to assume that there's reductions in co-pollutants as well, right? So a major oil refinery recently declared a goal of 10% reduction in energy use by 2012. Which refinery is that? Don't know. Doesn't say in here. But if the refinery sector as a whole achieved the 2020 goal, reduced greenhouse gas emissions by 19 to 12 million tons. So that's a very significant amount of reductions. And so I'm just trying to figure out, is this the measure that you're basically saying here is that they would do audits? And then what's the implementation of the audit?
Yeah, the implementation, we thought we have to start with kind of seeing what's out there
mm-hmm.
and then talk about implementation measures, for example, removal of the methane exemption.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we wanted them to go with this. Also recycling waste gases
mm-hmm.
instead of what they're doing now, which is burning them
mm-hmm.
Or dumping them. And we wanted them to look at what this trend on the kind of dirtier grades of crude oil, the heavier and dirtier grades of crude oil. So that's mm-hmm. kind of the direction that we wanted to go with this.
Okay. And then didn't someone bring up the issue of the statewide flaring rule at some point? Someone brought that up. Jesse brought that up. Okay. I remember something from
Jesse,
the thank
got,
you.
From we
the,
got a comment card from Jesse.
Yeah, okay, great. So maybe we should take.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
I mean,
we're only, the only reason that the only concern I have around the statewide flaring rule is if it would weaken the local control that, you know, and
the local
regulations.
Right.
Yeah,
well,
because, you know, sometimes
to,
that happens is that they undercut what we want at the local level.
Right. So we would have to talk about that it has to be at least as stringent. Okay,
yeah,
great.
Point of clarification. Bill, what do you refer to a methane exemption. Where's that coming from?
Well, right now, methane is unregulated. There's an exemption on the methane regulations, which is one of the copollutants that are being produced in the refinery process. So, you know, it's a significant greenhouse gas, you know, much more, much higher impact. And we think this is a loophole that should definitely be closed.
I thought at the last meeting when I don't recall the gentleman's name, I asked about the greenhouse gases, and it was mentioned that methane was covered under this process.
That's right. That's right. So this falls within that six gases that are included under that category.
Okay, so to clarify, there's a current exemption under the existing regulatory structure for methane. It's not regulated at refineries. Methane at refineries is not regulated at all. And so what Bill's proposal is to get rid of that exemption and to start regulating methane emissions essentially at refineries through this sort of, under this sort of rubric of energy efficiency and energy efficiency audits from recycling waste gases. Part of the waste gases are methane, right, Bill?
Yeah.
And Jane, just in terms on page 4, there's, you know, you were asking about implementation on the second large paragraph on the underlying section. Finally, as an initial measure to assist implementation of the low greenhouse gas standard and refinery cap, we urge ARB to recommend withholding approval of refinery modifications that would result in an increase in greenhouse gas emissions. I guess folks know that the refinery industry right now is taking advantage of the concern about high gas prices to say, we just don't have enough capacity. So let us, you know, bump it up 30% with Chevron, 25% with, almost every refinery has expansion plans. So we just want to make sure that, you know, even as we're trying to stop those things, we want to make sure that this greenhouse gas emissions are taken into account, for, you know, all in the process that's being undertaken on this.
Conceptually, I like the idea of this proposal, but I think, like Jane, I'm struggling with the language of it, that what's written here, I'm not clear if it's actually getting it, what the conversation is saying. And I don't know how we write it in a way that encapsulates what Bill's put forward, but actually leads to change over the next 10 years.
Can I just, I mean, I think part of what I think our chore is today is to get the things on the list. And then there's obviously going to be more dialogue and more analysis and more conversation. So I guess, are you talking about this one that's in the box? Is that the one you're concerned about?
Yeah, that's what, I mean, I get that Bill's asking for an audit to reduce CO2 and methane emissions at these refineries, but is an audit actually enough? Like, what's the action that we want tied to that?
Remember, early action measures are regulations, and so right, you have to have some, you know, what, how do you fit that into a regulatory package? What's the follow-up to the audit? Is it, you know, like recycling waste gases, that's a regulatory measure. Removing the methane exemption is a regulatory measure. My question is, you do an audit, it says here, you know, according to energy audits done by Lawrence Berkeley Lab, feasible effective measures to achieve greater energy efficiency in oil refineries are available. That's a great thing. How are those feasible and efficient measures to achieve energy efficiency going to be implemented in a regulatory program? That's the question I'm asking myself. So we need to word the recommendation such that it's not just an audit. We don't just want the audit. We want the activities that are identified in the audit to be gotten at in a regulatory program.
Well, the bolded part says audit, but then right the next part is and recommendations for implementation. So maybe we just say alternatives, and I'm just suggesting this, obviously up to you, audit and regulatory mechanisms to reduce CO2 and methane, and that's part of what the dialogue will be. I mean, I guess I would trust CBE and their analysis in terms of this is your recommendation. at least that gets us going and moving in that direction. So can we strengthen it by suggesting that to make it more clear, as Johnny was saying?
Yeah, that would be fine. Yeah, because we, you know, I think we especially had one and two in mind, as those are the actual implementation measures that we think right now they're doable, they meet all the criteria. So if we want to just say specifically regulatory measures, including recycling waste and removal of methane exemption, that would be fine. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, could we simply say identify and implement, you know, measures to reduce CO2 and methane? I think that would get at the issue of what we do next.
But it sounds to me like Bill would like to require these two, and I'm almost wondering if they should be standalone. Like, do they need to be tied to this audit?
Oh, I see.
You might identify things like boiler optimization, which is an artificial intelligence technology that they put in large boilers to reduce increase combustion efficiency, reduce emissions. Like, you know you want them to recycle the waste gases, and you know you want them to remove methane exemption. You might find other things through an audit that then you would add to this list. And I want to make sure that those things are captured in this, that we don't just do an audit, and then those gains in reductions, those emissions reductions are lost because we didn't do a strong enough recommendation.
Yeah, I hear what people are saying. I want to keep the audit in because they don't do it.
Right.
So who knows what they're going to find? These are at least the things we can find. These are at least the things we know about, which I think we should specify as regulatory.
Well, I guess regulatory my suggestion
measures.
Is that.
But we I don't want to take out. I don't want to have the. I don't want to separate them because I'm afraid then they'll get lost. The audit will become a thing of kind of a thing in itself. Mm-hmm. And there's two very clear measures that we think that they could do right now. But if the audit, that's why we had this number three, that it would include. You know, it leaves it open for anything else that this audit discovers. We could begin to look at regulatory
measures.
What
if we wrote it in a way such that it says that we require something around this oil refinery energy efficiency by, one, recycling waste gases, two, removal of methane exemptions, and then the third piece is requiring an audit to identify additional mechanisms, et cetera. I mean, you get where I'm going with it, but that we're requiring all three of those pieces, not just an audit that then may or may not require the following two that you know we need.
Are there any other comments?
I think just along the language, you could just say conduct an audit of, you know, the language here, conduct that audit and implement regulatory measures, including and the list of the things we were talking about and any other measures identified by the audit.
Yeah, I just don't want those two pieces to get lost. If they
right.
do an audit, usually an audit then allows some choice. And from
right.
what Bill's showed us or the information he's given us, it sounds like these we know have to happen regardless of what gets found in an audit.
We don't need the audit to identify
those.
Right.
Right. And so, Bill, to sort of capture what people are talking about here, what do you think about having three separate measures? Mm-hmm. The first measure is develop a regulation that requires recycling of waste gases instead of dumping or incinerating. The second measure is develop a remove the methane exemption, you know, develop a regulation that requires methane controls at refineries. And the third measure would be implement a regulation requiring energy efficiency audits at all refineries. And then, because that would be the early action measure, right? Outside of the early action measure period, there'd be follow-up recommendations if it were discovered at there were similar issues at several of the refineries, right? Because they're probably not going to write a recommendation if it's just one refinery has one particular issue, right? But they may well determine after they've done all of them that there are patterns that arise that would be appropriate to have a statewide regulation to address those patterns.
I think it's a great suggestion. I just like the third one for the audit to include, to make sure that it includes the language of an evaluation of alternative energy for those last three. Okay. I think that's a great suggestion.
Okay, Avi?
I just also had a quick question for you, Bill. You mentioned the language on page 4. Is that a separate recommendation? Is that an addendum to the current recommendation? I wasn't entirely clear on that.
Well, we actually, our focus a lot was on the page 2.
Okay.
Any other comments or conversation about this? Okay, so, Bill, would you like to propose a motion for the three? Do we want to do them all three together, or do we want to do them individually?
Do you want to work with Martha and Shoni here to actually write it while we go on, and then we can come back to it and vote on it so that it's written correctly? Because it sounds like there's a number of lists. Maybe you guys could just sort of caucus and help Martha write this. And then we could go on to the commercial refrigeration thing and then come back.
Okay.
And then you can read it and get it all tuned up. How does that sound? Okay.
The three of our members will be doing something else.
Okay.
I'm living in Kern County. I'm also very concerned with oil production having the same problems as refineries. It takes so much energy to produce steam for oil production, and it's so inefficient because they're burning coal and who knows, tires and everything to produce the steam to inject into the ground. Can the oil production just be attached to the oil refinery? It's the same, almost exactly the same.
Actually,
it's needing greater efficiency and reduce the off-gassing. And
Tom, could that be its own thing, that we have some comparable language for oil production to do the audit and investigate? And
yeah, it could be. I'm just not the one to write it, unfortunately.
Well, so just to remind folks, we do actually have an existing measure on methane and oil fields and gas distribution systems. I don't think it's maybe exactly what you're talking about, though. But this is actually a very, very interesting measure that came from a member of the public and talked about the oil field in Santa Barbara County that he's worked on for 23 years, and talked about the tremendous potential gains just from fixing leaks in the oil and gas distribution system, both during the extraction and then the distribution of the oil, of petroleum and natural gas. So that is a measure. And I don't know, we could amend that measure, or we could create a new measure, and I'm not sure, because it is talking specifically about methane and waste gases. Yes. Okay, let me see, which measure is that? I have the comment right in front of me, but I don't have the, yeah, it's one about the leaks from distribution of oil and gas.
Is that table 212, is that the measure?
Yes. Okay. Reduce venting leaks from oil and gas systems.
And we actually included that on our proposed, list of early action measures. It's our number 3, which I think captures that one.
2-12
and it's in its existing.
Right. And version. Let me just since we're on this, let me just read from the record that we have. In one instance at a major oil field, we sampled over 400 components and could not find one leak, even at 5 parts per million. We went to the utility gas connection where the gas was being sold, and 100% of the fittings leaked, about 50 in all. They sampled approximately 30 other utility locations that they found randomly. And found leaks. To show the magnitude of potential benefit, using ARB's numbers of fugitive emissions from valves and leaks in gas service, with 3 leak paths and 7,000 components, it goes on and basically multiplies out to 8.5 million metric tons of methane released each year. So it's, very substantial emissions and fairly easy fixes. So I don't know if that gets at what you're talking about, Tom.
Yeah, the waste and flaring and stuff gets at what I'm talking about.
Okay, so that's a different issue, because this is
just the word oil production in this oil systems, mm-hmm. Oil and gas systems should make sure it includes the actual production. don't want to leave that out.
I think that might be a comment that would be appropriate for hopefully the rulemaking process that would follow implementing this recommendation, right, in looking at venting and leaks from oil and gas systems and making sure that includes the entire production line.
Well, I think he's talking about something different.
Yeah, Tom, I just had a
Tom is
question.
Talking about something different. He's talking about the when they actually have boilers at oil fields, and they fire those boilers with everything, okay, and they make steam, and they inject the steam under the ground. He's saying that there's energy efficiency gains to be made at those boilers. It's at the boilers themselves. This isn't a distribution system, so it's totally different. So it really is a separate measure.
So basically, are we recommending an energy audit of the boilers? Is that?
Well, what he's talking about is that the same recommendation that, these guys are working on here at the refinery itself could apply. We could expand it to apply at the oil production facilities that are in California, not just at the refineries, which would be the audits and then burning the waste gases and then whatever the other one is.
I see. Okay.
So it's just it would be expanding it not only from the refinery itself, but also to the oil, extraction. So I don't know. I'm just trying to clarify what Tom is getting at.
So is there any other conversation about that, Avi, and then Laura?
So Tom, as I understand it, you're proposing that we repeat the three measures recommended for the refineries for the oil production process, basically.
Certainly, yes. I would recommend that.
That sounds good. I think instead of integrating refineries and boilers, maybe do one and the two. So.
Any other conversation about that? I would say if it's the will of the community to do that, then that's fine. I think that those It appears that that could be a substantial reduction measure, but I would note that this is a new measure that we're adding to the list that hasn't been previously reviewed by and commented upon CARB, and all of the other recommendations that we were making were based on things that were already submitted to CARB. So I think that we can make this recommendation, but we should just flag it as something that was developed independently by the committee, which is the purpose of the committee, right? That's why we have broad representation and people that have broad experience. So I think that it's fine, but I just want to urge us to flag it as a separate category.
I think that makes sense, but I also think it's a little bit of a lesson that when we, you know, the reason it came up is because a community member heard it. It made me think, well, wait a minute, I have that problem in my community. So the earlier we have the information, the earlier we can develop, have our thinking and develop our processes. So if there's a resistance to that on the part of ARB, then earlier information can help us mitigate that.
Good point.
We can share that.
Any other conversation about that?
No, but we need to develop the language for the recommendation.
I think the proposal was to
do exactly the same for oil. Instead of saying oil refinery, we say oil production.
Oil production.
Right. So we need to tell the drafting team here when they get done.
So we're going to duplicate that. So while they are finishing working on their recommendation, I noted in my opening comments that there was a measure that went unaddressed by the subcommittee meetings.
Okay, so I'm going to discuss that measure. I believe that this measure is having to do with switching the refrigerants. It's difficult for me to actually see because what the measure says in the table is, specifications for commercial refrigeration. And it has less than 7.3 million metric tons of reductions. That's from ARB's report on the early action measures. Now, the record that I have in front of me is replete with an extensive conversation on the replacements and the reductions of emissions of halogenated flame retardants. And just for the committee's interest, you might note that you had this, these retardants, these flame retardants, CFCs that were ozone depleters or ozone depleting chemicals that were phased out by the Montreal Protocol. And then they went to these halogenated flame retardants, essentially, that now are global warming gases. And now what they're proposing is to jump from that into, again, another new chemical, which is a fluorinated ketone, which many of the committee members, especially those with the environmental health expertise, raised eyebrows about, because fluorinated ketones would be suspect from their health effects. And in this, in the record, I have a chart that shows me different types of these flame suppressants, and it shows me a bunch of different information about them, including their radiative efficiency, their atmospheric lifetime, their global warming potential, and that global warming potential, which is on a 100-year horizon, talks about this specific report, and then the IPCC report in 1996. It talks about technical data, the demonstrated special capacities, the weight, the area, the volume, the emission rate, the cost, the investment cost, the additional service cost, the additional recovery cost, and the HCFC abatement cost, as well as multiple agent manufacturers. However, nowhere in this report, or in this actually very extensive record that I have in front of me, does it talk about the health impacts on any of the toxicity testing or the persistence or the bioaccumulation or anything on the human health side of what a fluorinated ketone is going to do when released in, by the millions of pounds into the atmosphere. So the committee expressed some grave concerns about us jumping once more from the fire into the frying pan and not really having complete information on the toxicity of fluorinated ketones. I note that this particular fluorinated ketone that they're talking about, which is FK5112, has been through a TSCA screen. But as you know, we have environmental health experts on our committee, and they know that the TSCA screen does not look at things like endocrine disruption or neurotoxic effects or respiratory toxicity or immunosuppression. So the committee specifically recommended that this be something that really requires a lot more thoughtfulness before we would make a recommendation, basically to switch from what is now a chemical that has a high global warming potential into a chemical that has potentially devastating human health impacts that we don't know. We don't have any information in the record that tells us what those health impacts are. And just to give you a little bit of a flavor of the potential, I always like to look at the catastrophic release potential, which in this case there is a fantastic study in the record using what's called the HEAP process, which is basically where the industry has looked at how much of this material actually escapes from these fire suppression systems. And they looked at extensive, I have to say that the industry has done a really good job of taking a look at voluntary measures and trying to figure out how much is getting into the environment and looking at other countries about production and manufacture and release of these chemicals. One of the most recent estimate from the Halon's Technical Options Committee of the size of the existing Halon bank and annual emissions rates is that the bank is 42,000 tons with 2,000 tons of emissions of Halon 1301 and 125,000 tons with 17,000 tons of emissions of Halon 1211. So these are not insignificant amounts, and they also noted that Halon 2402 was used mainly in the former Soviet Union, and no information on the banks or emissions were found in literature whatsoever. So it's very important for us to note that that if you switch to another chemical and that you do not have a very good idea of what the human health impacts from the chemicals release, that in the United States you might have a pretty good idea, in Europe you might have a pretty good idea about how much is being emitted. When you get into other countries, you have virtually no information whatsoever. So,
I don't understand what we're talking about.
We're talking about the commercial, that's what this is. It's a switch from an existing chemical in fire suppression, commercial fire suppression systems. Okay? That's what specifications for commercial refrigeration, I believe that's what it is, because it's the information that I have in the record that looks like commercial refrigeration. It's the chemicals that are in the refrigeration units.
So I do remember that we had a conversation about this at the subcommittee meeting, but it must have been removed somehow from our list. So what do we want to do about this? Is this a express concern? This is where we express concern. We wanted to have a complete life cycle analysis before recommending moving to another chemical.
Is that why this measure, because this measure was sort of a sub-measure of these other HCFC measures, or I don't know, maybe this is a completely different measure.
Wait, Lobby?
So I just want to clarify. We are talking about number 2-10, is that correct, the fire suppression measure? Is that
2-3.
Okay.
Specifications of commercial refrigeration.
I see, okay.
I don't know. Fire retardant.
It's on here.
Yeah, is that removed from our list? Yeah, maybe just removed from our list somehow in all the various situations. Yeah, how come that's not? I think you're talking about 2-10, fire suppression. Okay, so we've done some version of individual and collective head scratching around this, and I think that maybe what we want to do is for item number 2-3, specifications for commercial refrigeration, maybe we want to leave that as we don't have adequate information to make a recommendation, because I think that what Jane was just outlining is information that would be tied to item number 2-10, fire suppression, replacing high global warming potential gases with some kind of an alternate chemical, where we did say that we wanted to have complete life cycle analysis before we made such a switch.
Maybe we should ask for public comment.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to say. So can I, do we have any other conversation that we want to have about the proposed list of early action measures? And if I can urge us to wrap up that conversation so we can take public comment, that would be great.
And just want to make sure. So what we're saying about 2-3 is we don't have enough information.
I don't think we have information in our record. Jane's double checking the record to make sure.
Okay. Great.
Were you signaling you wanted to say something?
I just have one other question I want to ask. One of the things that resonated with me anyway, it's from a letter from Center for Biological Diversity, is about the CEQA. And I understand that CARB doesn't have some direct authority over CEQA, but there's also some things about guidance and protocols for local governments. And so, again, I think there's the four or five big areas, and then there's what can we facilitate happening on the local level and how CEQA is applied and how global warming is treated under CEQA. Maybe someone else can help me with how we could achieve that, but it's something that's happening a lot. We see it a lot where it's really not being adequately addressed. I think they make a good case in their letter about it. Whether it's an early action item or not, I don't know, but I'd like it to be somewhere that we're flagging it, because how CEQA plays out in our communities is very significant. So anyone have any brilliant ideas about how we could move that forward? Or should we?
Well, I think, unfortunately, what we decided was it's not a regulatory program that CARB has jurisdiction over. I mean, I think clearly it seems like in the chart that went to somebody.
Well, in group two, they have a number of education.
Yeah,
and
they
have them too.
Right.
In ours that are not regulatory, they're educational. So
of the ones that were included, that's right, they included in their table two that were clearly educational. I think on the CEQA thing, that would be working
resources.
With resources,
right.
And it may be included on the attachment, actually.
That's what I was thinking. I thought it went to resources.
Yeah, it's included on attachment B, item number B38, greenhouse gases and general plans in CEQA.
Okay.
And it looks like they're taking joint authority, which I guess is maybe working with resources to develop that. And so the project that we undertook was at the subcommittee level was to look at measures, to comment upon the measures that were in the report, and particularly to flag those that we believe should be early action measures. So we didn't review those items in attachment B for things that we thought were good ideas but not early action measures. We commented on the two because they included those two in table two. But I agree that CEQA is an important, it's an important component, and following up on your earlier suggestion that the committee figure out a way to think about how we would work with CARB to address greenhouse gas emissions sort of over the longer term and what the next steps are after they get through the early actions points and focusing on those areas that you outlined. I think maybe we can include CEQA as part of the conversation.
Or local there. Planning or something.
Local planning, right. Avi, did you have a comment? Any other comments? Were you guys able to work out recommendation language?
Yes.
Okay, so let's do that, and then we can have public comment.
Okay. So we'd like here's a recommendation.
Use the microphone, please.
We recommend CARB undertake and adopt regulatory measures to increase oil refinery energy efficiency and reduce greenhouse gases. Specifically, we recommend that CARB undertake and adopt regulatory measures that require recycling of waste instead of dumping and incineration of waste. We recommend CARB undertake and adopt regulatory measures to eliminate methane exemptions and require methane control measures at refineries. Implement energy efficiency measures that include but are not limited to an energy audit. The audit shall consider and address alternative energy for refinery electricity consumption, the impact of heavier crude oil modifications on greenhouse gas emissions, and other energy efficiency measures.
That was so good, it made my orange juice bottle fall over. Okay, so since you read that, can I also attribute to you the
motion to, yes, you know, I forget my Robert's Rules of Order. Because.
The language was originally written as waste gases, but I think you just read just waste. So is that, do we want gases? I don't know. I'm just asking.
Yes, we just, that was an oversight. Yes.
Okay.
Good ear.
Very good.
So now are you second? Okay.
Okay, it's been seconded.
And so any other conversation about those recommendations, that recommendation? All in favor of the adopting the recommendations? Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. I think I heard some people out there opposing it now. We wanted to adopt a parallel measure for the oil production sites. Right? And so we were going to use that exact same language, but we were going to replace the word a refinery with at production facilities, oil production. Copy it, yeah. So can we keeping in mind what we just heard 47 seconds ago, can we vote on the second thing, which will be identical except for the different words? I'm asking if we have a motion for that. Okay. And
second.
Okay. Any other conversation about that? Okay. Everyone who supports adopting the proposed recommendation, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. So that's those two recommendations. We'll add those to our list of early recommendations. I will undertake incorporating all of these things into a new document and getting it out, and I will give that to Johnny. Johnny will post it on our website, and then we will forward that to ARB with a cover letter that captures those cover concerns that we talked about.
Angela, just one question on back on the power plants. We just said aging, and frankly, anything that's built is aging. So we had defined aging as 100, over 100 megawatts and built prior to 1980. Okay. Do you think that's necessary to put in there, or maybe just by?
We should clarify that.
Okay. So okay. Aging power plants as defined by all districts.
Okay, so we'll act like we did all the motions and to modify that recommendation to add prior to 1980 over 100 megawatts.
Right. Any dissent on that?
Okay. Great.
Oh, wait. I found the specification for commercial refrigeration. It's in DuPont's letter. It's one paragraph. Would you like to hear it? DuPont supports, this initiative, supports the action suggested. Commercial refrigeration is a significant source of refrigerant emissions, that there's a need for significant improvement. Heavily relying on ozone-depleting refrigerants, and the highest priority should be policies that encourage the conversion of existing equipment to alternative non-ozone-depleting refrigerants and lower global warming alternatives while addressing the problems of leaks. So it is the same issue.
Okay. So it's an HFC's issue, and so I remember we talked in the subcommittee about bundling all of those into the one that would replace the one for the small cans, right? So.
Well, this is not just this is the small cans and the alternative problem.
Right. Okay. So I will. So our recommendation was to not move forward without knowing what you're moving forward to, right? Okay.
Don't jump on it.
So I will amend the document to reflect that the chart to reflect that recommendation from the committee. Okay. We've got one comment card. No, it's the empty stack. We've got more comment cards flowing in from the audience.
Yeah.
So Jesse Marquez. Turn on your microphone. If there's some on button, maybe on the stem. Oh, there you go.
Jesse Marquez, Executive Director, Coalition for a Safe Environment. I did want to thank the committee because they did incorporate HFCs from my decommissioned containers, but we do need to add one more little line to that because it provides a loophole. In addition to decommissioned containers and or containers put into long-term storage, meaning over 6 months. Because technically they can say they're just being stored and not being decommissioned, but they'll still sit there for 5-6 years deteriorating. So I wanted to close that little loophole.
So I just want to let you know that in the interim, I've been to the automotive service store with my car, and my car has leaked out a small amount of its refrigerant, and they could not find where the leak was, and so they put a special dye in there and asked me to drive the car for like a month and come back, and they will look for the dye with a black light. And I'm thinking, So I don't know why we wouldn't look for the refrigerant leaks all the time, right? I mean, why wouldn't you, in existing cargo containers and existing refrigeration units, why wouldn't you, if you could inject this dye in there and then go look for it with a black light, why wouldn't you be always doing that? Not just the aging ones, not just the ones sitting out in the cemetery, right? But all the time, because you've got essentially this problem is the problem at PCBs, where you've got a chemical that's very dangerous, but you're still using it in commerce, and even after you ban it, it will still be in commerce for at least another generation or two. And PCBs are difficult to find and expensive to find, but this is relatively cheap to find. You put a dye in there, and you wave the black light. Mm-hmm. And the guy at the local AAA service center can do it. I mean, certainly we could do it in cargo containers. You could do it in commercial refrigeration units. You could be constantly looking for, it gets back to the refineries with the leaks and the vents.
Yeah, just one comment on that. I understand what you're saying, both of you, Jane, and brother here. But in terms of the question you raised, Jane, about the routine checking or monitoring. Do we have any knowledge or awareness as to the extent of any leak problem that would justify that ongoing type of action?
Well, remember, these particular chemicals have global warming potentials that are astronomical. Like methane's 30 mm-hmm. years. These are like one of the worst. And if it's that inexpensive and that easy to check for leaks, like we're talking in cargo containers, refrigeration units that are charged with huge amounts of these. It's not like your car where it's like, you know, an ounce or two. These refrigeration units and commercial refrigeration units have, you know, pounds of this stuff in them.
And we're not talking few. We're talking tens of thousands of them that are being stored alongside the regular containers. But the only problem is that they're stored in residential communities, or they border residential communities because of the industrial park where it's located.
Right, and I think that the same thing is with commercial refrigeration units, where they're charged with, you know, fairly large amounts of these chemicals. Not like your car's got a certain amount in it too, but larger units would then, when they're leaking a lot of this. Uh-huh. And so requiring, you know, I don't know exactly how they would do it, but we just felt that the subcommittee felt like CARB could be really looking at how much of this stuff is in these containers, how much of it is commercial refrigeration units, and how costly could it possibly be to go up on the top of this building once a year and look to see if the thing is leaking or not. So
that would be subsumed in the recommendation around the small cans, where we asked CARB to instead to expand and look at a suite of HFC possible reduction measures,
which would include annual inspections, for example, or inspection prior to release to the public, or prior to put into a container yard,
something of that nature.
This is extremely inexpensive technology. I mean, the cost is having the guy with the black light go out and look for where the leak is and then repair the leak. Right. It's very inexpensive.
Laura had
But Jesse, comment? which is the recommendation that you wanted the additional language added to, just so I can find it?
It's in 2-, it would be in 1-2.
Yeah, 1-2.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
So it would be and or place into long-term storage.
So we can add that language, but we're not recommending that for early action anyway.
Yes. Okay. And just to clarify a little bit what Bill was mentioning, Tom was mentioning about the petroleum industry. Back in the day, a company was a oil gas exploration company. It was the oil drilling company. It was the pipeline company. It was the oil refinery company. And it was the distribution company. That doesn't exist now. What we have is that you have private companies that all they do is drill. And then they connect to existing pipelines. Well, what's happened now in California, United States, probably over 50% of all pipelines are no longer owned by oil refinery or oil companies. They're owned by private, independently owned pipeline companies. Kinder Morgan is now the largest independent owner of gas and fuel pipelines in the United States. So it's not an oil refinery. It's not an oil company. It is also the largest owner of fuel storage tank facilities in the United States. It's also the largest owner of port bulk loading terminals of fuels and gases in the United States. So these other companies are normally not under the radar, and that's why what we do here has to include these private entities so that they are scooped up in that process. One thing Jane alluded to earlier that did also not show up, and that was in terms of floating roof fuel storage tank facilities at oil refineries and at private independent fuel storage tank facilities.
That was a comment that you made in earlier.
I had made it earlier, but it didn't show up as one of the early action measures, okay? Like in the South Coast, we did pass a rule 2 years ago that by 2008, all open floating roof tanks had to have a dome or cover put on them. But that only applies there. But this is something that can be implemented statewide as a policy and as a regulation. Another thing that shows up, again related to the petroleum industry, are abandoned oil wells. An example, Wilmington is approximately 4 miles by 4 miles square on the land side. We have over 600 oil wells. Over 400 of them have been what they call abandoned, which means they're no longer in use, but they've not been cemented, they may not been not been sealed, they have not been capped off. They are never inspected. Every year, we have them breaking down in a residential area. So I am proposing that we have annual inspections and that they be sealed upon discovery of their leaking, because they're always constantly leaking. You can walk through almost any community, and these are within empty lots of houses where people live, and you can just look over your fence, take a whiff, and smell it.
Okay, so that is a really good point. We could add that to the existing measure that we have. We could just amend the existing measure that we have on the distribution, oil distribution lines. Because it is a really significant problem that Dogger is not out there making sure that those wells are not creating a pathway for the gas emissions to escape.
And then related to that, when you talk about more efficient methane gas capture, while we have landfills in Wilmington and in Carson that have methane capture, but the pipelines are all leaking. So you can walk by, you can drive by, workers are working next to these pipelines, and you can just smell the methane gas leaking. So that has to be tied in as well.
Right. Okay, so the current measure is reduce venting and leaks from oil and gas systems. Those should be just like distribution systems. But what we could is just amend this and talk about the wells, the abandoned wells.
Right.
And our comment here is the potential for emissions reductions from the whole production and distribution chain for oil and gas has great potential. And the comment letter that we had in the record was just on the distribution systems. What we would just do again is amend it to say, this is measure 2-12. It's 2-12. Yeah, that's simple. Thank you for that comment, Jesse.
Okay, another thing.
This is from the community where it has 400 gas wells, like in 3 square miles, right?
Are we going to address the other issue that you said about the pipeline?
Well, I think that that's in this measure, where we're reducing venting and leaks from oil and gas distribution systems.
Now, it's not a distribution center. It's a methane gas recovery system. And they might make a distinction. Well, hey, this is separate. This is not a distribution center. We're just capturing the methane gas.
And Jesse, are you talking about the landfill capture measure, the 1-3, you would add it to that?
Yes.
Perhaps? Okay.
Which one was that?
Sorry, it's 1-3. 1-3.
So that would just be they're doing a early action measure for improved landfill capture, methane capture. I would suspect that
I viewed it as being equipment to suck it up more efficiently and that type of thing. But this is my case. It's leaking from the pipes.
So that's an
maintenance
and enforcement issue. I guess I'm inclined to think that that's a it's a reminder that having the regulation without adequate enforcement only gets you part of where you need to go. And I know they've talked about other enforcement mechanisms and having enhanced enforcement. And so I actually don't know that I would think that it's a amendment to the action measure more than it is a note to ARB that putting the capture equipment on there is great, and we appreciate that and think that's an important step, but periodically someone should go and make sure it's not leaking.
And it's leaking every day. Okay.
Right, okay, so we've got reduced venting and leaks from oil and gas distribution systems. We want to just add an extraction wells. Who's got the table in there? Do you have the table?
We would have to vote for that.
Yeah, I know. I'm just trying to figure out how we're going to. Okay.
So amend 1.1-3 to add extraction.
No, it's 2-12. Yeah. Okay. So what we would be doing is amending our measure 2-12 on oil and gas, which is reducing venting and leaks from oil and gas systems, which we recommended for an early action measure. We would amend it by just adding and extraction wells. Okay, so I'll move that.
Any other conversation about that proposed amendment?
Did we add the containers in long-term storage?
Yes.
Is it okay?
Yeah, it's included in 1-2.
Okay.
Long-term storage. That's right. We wanted to.
You didn't vote on it.
Yeah, we just let's do this one because it's the extraction wells. We're adding the extraction wells to 2-12, then we'll go back to the other one. So we have a motion and a second.
Any
other discussion?
Any other discussion on that proposed recommendation? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. And then the second piece would be to go back to 2-2, and we had comments that we were submitting on 2-2, recommending that it be replaced with, I'm sorry, 1-2, recommending that it be replacing the ban on small cans and instead doing the comprehensive analysis of HFC reduction measures. And our recommendation, I think, would be the same, which is to remove it from the early action list. So I think that what we're doing is adding refrigerants and decommissioned cargo containers, and adding decommissioned and long-term storage.
Is it implied that this one will be removed from early action but will be put to table two, for example? Just say remove it. I just want to be sure we remove it and put it somewhere else.
I think that the proposal from the subcommittee was to remove it and have it be removed.
But where will it go then?
It go away.
It goes away.
So we're actually suggesting a replacement. We're removing that one and suggesting a much more comprehensive.
Instead, do the broader analysis of HFC reductions, because at the subcommittee, what we discussed was there seemed to be all these other options to get the reductions from this important emission that didn't have the regressive impacts.
Gotcha. But so is our new recommendation, do we want that in early actions?
Yes.
Okay, because the way it reads is we have our recommendation, and then it says remove from early action list. As a where does it say?
And,
we want
and then
this
in the
done.
Discussion box,
yeah,
we recommend instead.
Okay.
I think what you're saying is for clarity, for clarity, we can move that first paragraph into the recommendation section.
Yeah, I just want to be sure that they know, because if you just look at it, 1-2 is gone. Okay, fine, but we actually have our own replacement of that that we actually do want in the list.
Right.
So maybe even in the recommendation, yeah. Perfect.
In the
maybe we shouldn't even put it in 1-2. Maybe it should have its own thing.
Yeah.
Right.
New grant. So remove this one.
1-2B.
1-2B.
Redux. Or no, we just do it all, remove it all together, and then we just put it in 2, and make it
its
separate
own
measure.
Okay.
So we want to make clear it's our response to 1-2.
Right. So right. Here's what we'll do. How about this?
Whatever you want.
Here's about this.
I'll be quiet.
We will leave our chart like this. You're helping. Leave this chart like this. We've got our new proposed list. On our new proposed list, we'll add these measures to the list. That'll make our list longer, but it will incorporate each of these measures. Okay. Linda? That's what we're trying to do here. We're trying to take
She can tell.
We don't want this one to go forward. We want these other HFCs to go forward.
Right. There's
okay.
Lots of opportunity for the HFC reductions.
Okay.
We need to rate that then.
Martha's got it.
That's good. Okay. Wordsmithing it.
Okay.
Did you have?
I have more. I have three more.
Three more. Okay.
Oh, gosh.
Okay. The next one deals with the gases from fluorescent lamps. For example, the city of Los Angeles has a fluorescent lamp graveyard, which has probably about 100,000 lamps it's been collecting there. Probably half or more are broken. And I'm sure every city, county, and federal government agency has a fluorescent lamp graveyard where they're not properly disposing them. They're just piling them on top of the pile on top of the pile. And we're talking hundreds of thousands and hundreds of thousands.
Jesse, you're recommending a totally new early action measure that was not included?
Yes.
Okay.
This would be a new one.
Let me just, before we do that, let me just ask, I don't know how we wanted to handle this. If we were taking, if the committee is prepared to recommend measures that had not previously gone before ARB, if that's...
I think we are. We have done that, so okay. I think we are prepared to do that.
Okay. So fluorescent lamp graveyards.
So the proposal would be to establish some new policy and regulation so that they are put under control and they're properly disposed of.
Do they have global warming gases in them?
From my understanding, they do.
Fluorescent lights do? I know they have mercury in them, which is a real significant public health problem. Mm-hmm. And we've been trying to get a fluorescent lamp recycling program started in the state for over a decade. Unsuccessfully so far, but I didn't realize that they have global warming gases in them.
Can we?
We don't have any information.
Can we get more
record
information?
We'll forward this to ARB as a proposed measure.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Thanks.
Okay.
And that is a proposed early measure. We'll receive testimony about it. We'll forward it to ARB.
Okay. What else?
Okay, another new easy one is something I brought up in the past, bit dealing with the prohibition of outdoor fumigation of containers using methyl bromide.
How come that's not in here?
And basically, we have a company in Wilmington, California Cotton. They are permitted by the Department of Agriculture, by every government agency you can think of, even though they have a 100,000 square foot building, and even though they in the past have done it, it's much easier to park it in the back, throw a tarp over it, and fumigate it on the outside. So I'm proposing the prohibition of outdoor fumigation of containers using methyl bromide.
Jesse, does that fall under DPR's new fumigant regulations that they just put out?
Ports are exempt from almost everything.
Okay.
And they're the only ones that are permitted to still use methyl bromide.
I'd rather see us eliminate that there's other ways to actually deal with this issue, and I'd rather see us not use methyl bromide indoor or outdoor, because then when you have it, unless you've got the whole capture system, Jesse, maybe you and I can work on something so that we're not giving them the out that they can continue to use it.
Yeah, and I'm just backing up on the fluorescent light bulb. I mean, do we have information about whether they have them or not? I guess I would maybe flag it as we would like more information about it, but I would not, I guess not, I'm not ready to put it on the list because I don't know we don't know which ones and how much, and I think maybe it's a lot, maybe it's not a lot. I'd be more cautious
about
that.
Forward as a early action measure on our list. I think we can forward it as someone came to our committee, testified about this, and this is something we would like ARB to.
Because we want to make sure that the ones we have will get us big gains, and I don't want to dilute the message with. So if that's acceptable, then hopefully, at least we flagged it, and we do need to get more information about it.
And the methyl bromide one, I remember you brought that up in testimony before. But can I suggest? I don't know how you want to handle this. We can forward that one additionally to ARB. There seems to be concern from, I don't know, at least one committee member so far. I don't know if we want to talk about it some more. Two committee members. Can I recommend that you work with Martha and Shioni to come up with something? Because the ARB board will meet on the 21st of June. And.
Okay, well, we saw it as an early action measure because it's something that can be done, like, today.
You
can prohibit it immediately while we're still dealing with the whole issue of eliminating it in its totality. So I saw it in terms of that nature as an early action measure.
Do other committee members have comments on the methyl bromide measure? The two public health members seem to be.
Right, so it sounds to me like the issue here is that people don't want to be using methyl bromide for anything, not only because of its greenhouse gas potential, because of its human health impacts. And so that the recommendation would much rather be, let's look at an alternative IPM strategy. Is that right? Is that basically where you guys are?
You guys did that in San Diego.
Well, we got it banned for use in our port area, but that doesn't mean they're not taking the containers somewhere else. I guess my feeling, not again having processes fully, I would defer to the two of you that are working on it more directly, the three of you, because I think they're strategic questions. You also don't want to say, okay, fine, we'll do that, and then that's their excuse to not do something else. I don't know what the bigger strategy is around that, so I would defer to the two of you, and again, you know, take a note and raise it, but not include it.
Well, it's very clear that these other global warming gases in other industries, they're moving towards alternatives, they're moving towards different chemicals or different ways of doing things. So, I mean, I think that saying using methyl bromide, which has a powerful global warming potential, is just a bad idea. And if we have an alternative, which is integrated pest management, why would you do it?
And we can work on the languages, is one that we recommend that this particular use also be included in DPR's methyl bromide current regulations, and that we can actually provide a push to the fact that we've been wanting, that this stuff has been set for phase out for years and years, and we haven't gotten any closer to it. So if you and I can work on some sort of language that moves that agenda forward, that would be great.
So people understand, this is fence line. We have residents that live on the other side of the fence from it, churches, hotels, small businesses, and we are the largest user in California. We're number one in that category of use. So we took it as an early action measure that can be done. It just tells them, do it indoors. You have the facility to do it indoors already, and you have a 100,000 square foot facility, so it's not a problem because you did it in the past. They just deviated from that is what's happened.
What do you want to do? I don't know that that's a regulation that for adoption by 2010, if you have to go through you don't need to go through a rulemaking process in order to get that to happen, do you? What do we want to do with this?
I'd like to just add a few comments to that. Jesse's here and he's telling us about a real problem that's happening in the community. Mm-hmm. And he's presenting a simple idea, you know, as to how to really start working on what's happening in that community. And I don't think what he's asking is way out there. And I think if it's easy enough to add it, I would be happy to add some kind of language in early practice. He wants something to happen quick. You don't want to wait 10 years until the Department of Pesticide Regulation decides that methyl bromide is no longer acceptable. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I would support an idea, some language on that.
Avi, and then?
I think I agree that it's a concern, but I think I also share your concern that this may not be a regulatory or early action measure, and we should definitely forward the suggestion. I'm not sure whether we can put it on the early action measures list.
Laura,
I agree. We have had horrible problems with methyl bromide, and we want to get rid of it. I just can't. I don't know the strategy by which the impacted communities. I mean, I'm hearing that your strategy is to put it on the early actions list. So, is there recommended language that would go? I guess I just wanted to have something in front of us and be sure that those groups who are actively working on it are in agreement that is the right strategic move to make, and if I can hear that, then
What we're requesting is prohibition of outdoor fumigation of containers using methyl bromide. It doesn't prohibit it from using it, but they do have an existing building that they traditionally already do it. So they're just deviating from it, and right. Commissioners are allowing them to do it.
So the issue is that there is a number of ways to go. Mm-hmm. So one would be, they aren't following the regulations, so that's something that we take up with the Ag Commissioner, that they're actually not following the existing regulations. There is existing regulations that say you can't do this outdoors. Well, they're doing that. So there is a way to actually deal with this by forcing the local Ag Commissioner to act. The second is there's a whole bunch of other little, you know, it's not listed on the Prop 65 list. There's a whole bunch of other kind of angles to take this on. And so it is a little confusing, like, if we put it on an early action measure, would that get it stopped any quicker than Jesse, you and I hammering at the local Ag Commissioner with our other hats on as pesticide reform advocates? So, I mean, I think that's the question.
So there's already existing regulations that prohibits outdoor fumigation?
Well, there's a buffer zone. that they're not, they're also not respecting?
The state manual states it must be 1,000 feet from the nearest resident, while the other side of the fence is 50 feet away.
So that's a, that's okay. An enforcement violation.
Yeah.
Yeah, but see, but they allow them to write the permits for any distance. So you'll find them for 50 feet, 70 feet, 100 feet, 200
okay.
feet, 300
How about,
feet.
Let me make this recommendation. Why don't we, in our cover letter, where we are addressing a number of concerns, raise this issue for review by ARB for additional controls based on its global warming potential, and flag the issue. This would be one of those measures that would meet the criteria for early action, but unless we can work out something between now and the time that we actually would do the letter, it's unclear, the committee is unclear about whether or not it's an ARB jurisdiction issue.
Because I agree. To the extent that this is an enforcement question, there are other lack of enforcement issues have come up too, yeah. So that could be roped into that. So, you know, we've noticed in these discussions, all of these huge enforcement holes, and we need you to fill them or do whatever. So how does that sound, Jesse?
And maybe there's actually a, maybe there's the formation for an early action measure. We could always, on enforcement, right? They note one in their report, and there are probably others where there are existing regulations. We know that enforcement, not just on greenhouse gas issues, but on a lot of issues, is not as robust as one might hope. So can we forward it as part of our letter, flagging that this is a place where they can, through enforcement, ARB could help with the enforcement, perhaps by going to the Ag Commissioners, if that's the appropriate jurisdiction, to encourage the Ag Commission to enforce these regulations and require indoor fumigation. We can perhaps ask ARB to use its new mandate to address greenhouse gases to step into that, much in the way that the Energy Commission asked that the refinery not be taken offline for to meet the high hydrofluorocarbon.
Right. The Energy Commissioners, the Energy Commission issued a letter saying don't shut down the one refinery to change out the HFs because it's going to have an impact on gas security.
Right. In violation of an order from the South Coast AQMD. Yeah. So we know that there are state agencies that will facilitate such things happening. So we will. And this is, and we should just flag this as an issue that I know that you testified about this at the early action meeting that ARB held. We've talked about this. It's not reflected in their report anywhere. They haven't addressed it. They haven't kicked it to somebody else. They haven't done anything. And that's problematic that this very real reduction and health impact is not being addressed in the context of this process, even though it was brought to ARB on multiple occasions to figure out a way to address it. And so this committee will do what it can to make sure that that issue gets clearly flagged at ARB and that our steps are taken to address it.
Mm-hmm. Good, thank you.
One more, Jesse?
Okay, and one more. This is sort of related to what Bill was alluding to, but clarifying a little bit more in terms of flaring. Well, we have situations where wherever there's oil refineries, fuel storage tank facilities, and oil wells, flaring is occurring, which is outgassing. And typically, it's at its worst when they have mechanical breakdowns and malfunctions and things of that nature. In the case of the South Coast, we have a new flare rule, which has kicked in as of this year, which requires establishment of a flare minimization plan, which is like the first step. But the truth of the matter is that all flaring can be prevented. All it requires is installing a vapor recovery system and building the tanks capable of accepting the gas when they do have a problem. And so we see that as a possible early action measure that can be done. They can build a tank in less than 1 year. So I don't know if you want to tie it into part of what Bill was mentioning under that one measure, or if you want to include it as a separate measure.
Actually, I think that Bill wanted to not move forward with the flaring, statewide flaring rule as an early action measure, and instead to focus on.
I hear where Jess is coming from. I'm wondering if that could be included under the audit
piece of this. You know, I'm just always worried, you know, we kind of win something on the local level, and then it kind of gets preempted up at the state level, and then the local folks don't want to do, they don't want to move forward. So that's the, that's my only concern. But I think this is, you know, it should be, I think, one of the specifications on the audit.
On the audit is, I want to make sure the use of vapor recovery systems and tanks.
Yeah. And storage tanks. Part of the problem is, well, we have nowhere to put it. Yeah. That's because they don't build an empty tank there, so they can put it there. Then it requires a compressor to be able to pump it from wherever the malfunction is into the tank. But it is totally feasible. They do it already. They just don't want to do it for that. And I would just like to thank the committee for accepting public comments and that you continue to accept both verbal and written comments from other people that may not be able to be here today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jesse.
And on that note, I just wanted to mention again to the people that are listening to us on the webcast, there is a way to email comments and questions to the committee. Should send them to onair, all one word, at arb.ca.gov. So we have one last card from Nick Lapis.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Nick Lapis. I'm representing Californians Against Waste. And I'd like to start off first by thanking the committee for all the work you've done. We definitely appreciate it. What you're doing is very important, and in the whole scope of this whole global warming issue, it's important that we don't forget the environmental justice impacts. I have a question about item number 23 on your list of the new early action measures. And item 23 says adopt South Coast and San Joaquin rules on enclosed composting facilities statewide. And I just have a clarifying question as to what is the basis for including that, given that the rules are in San Joaquin and South Coast are for criteria pollutants, not for global warming gases, because the rules are for ammonia and VOC.
We believe those technologies can also capture methane, like the landfill capture does as well. And so the idea is you can capture not only criteria pollutants but also methane from composting.
Well, the current South Coast and San Joaquin rules do not address methane at all. So the way the measure is written right now, it says adopt the rules on a statewide basis. And
so are you recommending a amendment to reflect that it should actually capture methane? I think if that's what you're recommending, that's an appropriate amendment.
I'm actually recommending that you not include this on the list of early action measures. A well-managed compost facility should not be creating methane. And methane is created only if a compost facility is not managed well. So in general, it hasn't been that much of an issue.
We're talking about manure piles here as well. That's part of the reason we're talking about, we're talking about the composting of the manure. Yeah. So you're talking,
The current rules are for co-composting, which is biosolids, but they're also about to propose rules for green waste composting. And in terms of the composting of biosolids, the alternative is land applying, in which case it does become anaerobic. And if it becomes anaerobic, then it produces methane.
So if you would clarify a little bit, so what you're saying is if the manure is composted and it will not produce methane?
It should not produce methane if it's composted.
Okay.
Would it produce methane if it were composted incorrectly?
Yes, that is possible. But either way, the way the proposed or the way your early action measure is written, it does not address any greenhouse gases at all.
Well, just for clarification, the line that you see as number 23 on the list is our short description based upon letters that were submitted to ARB outlining this measure and using the proposed rules, the proposed model rules at the AQMD in South Coast, extend those statewide, so that they would also capture some nine million metric tons of CO2 equivalent emissions of methane. So it sounds like there is a disagreement as to whether or not methane actually, there's an issue always about if it's done correctly, then this won't happen. It's kind of like if, you know, pretty much if anything is done correctly, then
right.
bad stuff doesn't happen. But in the real world, it appears that often it's not done correctly, and therefore there are these emissions and that there ought to be controls on them.
Yeah. I mean, again, we were recommending this because we think it's something that can be done fairly easily. If during the process ARB finds out that there's any issues that can come out during the process, but we think that, you know, methane, as you point out, if it's not done correctly, it will produce methane. So we want to look at that eventuality and the fact that it actually is happening in the real world, and there's a solution that can deal with that problem.
So to clarify, this would include expanding the South Coast and San Joaquin rules to include methane capture?
That would be correct. Perhaps to address any confusion on that issue, we should just add language saying that it would address methane emissions.
To address methane emissions.
Mm-hmm.
Does that help?
Well, I'm not really making that decision. I'm actually speaking on behalf of my boss, who couldn't attend because of a prior arrangement.
Was that, is
we
that
just
Scott?
Wanted clarification. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
we
I
just
talked to Scott last night, actually, about this,
okay.
Just so you know. So I did talk with Scott Smith-Klein last night about it, and I just want to refer us back to the language that's in the record. CARB should consider a statewide composting rule to capture emissions from manure composting. There are already two such air district rules, San Joaquin Rule 4565 and South Coast Rule 1133.2, which aim to capture non-methane emissions from composting, including manure composting. Methane emissions from the manure being composted can be captured in the same manner using in-vessel composting or aerated static piles. These rules should be applied to animal facilities statewide to capture methane emissions. And the committee specifically found that there are actually a number of composting facilities around the state that compost a number of different things. These manure composting facilities are very similar to biosolids, which are sewage sludge composting facilities, which actually have the same problem, very, very large methane emissions, as well as criteria pollutant emissions. And what you're seeing around the state is that as South Coast adopted its rule and then San Joaquin followed, now what you basically have are what I would politely call uncontrolled air districts, where now those facilities are going. And those are communities like Hinckley and communities like Brawley, small environmental justice communities in very, very poor areas of the state where you can't do it. You can't do open air composting in urban areas or in other tightly controlled air districts. Now you're going to go to these other districts. And that's a tremendous environmental justice issue that's happening in the state. So the subcommittee specifically looked at this very closely and found that there was fantastic reductions from manure composting and biosolids composting that could be had by following or extending the rules that were already adopted in two of the air districts. So that's basically what this measure is about. And we can certainly, in our short descriptive language, we can clarify that we're talking about, obviously, greenhouse gas emissions from composting facilities.
I agree with that suggestion.
Thank you.
And Nick, so here at our committee, we capture the comments that are made to us, and I make notes on your cards. And so I have noted on your card your comments and have flagged in particular the question to be addressed during a rulemaking process is, what are the methane emissions that come from composting, given that if composting is done correctly, there should be no such emissions. So I'll flag that. It'll come from the committee flag to ARB.
And I actually like to add to that, and that is that we're talking about there's a number of different things that are being composted in California. There's manure, there's biosolids, and there's green waste. And then there's a number of facilities that co-compost green waste and biosolids. And that it's not clear that the green waste composting is a significant greenhouse gas emitter. We don't know. So if you could add that to the comment card, and concerns have been expressed that forcing the enclosure of green waste composting facilities could make them uneconomical, and that that waste would then be diverted back into a landfill, which is, you know, methane and air toxic source. And I also think that gets back to the digester issue, which the digester guy's not here, but, you know, the digester issue where we don't understand why green waste in California can't be going to digesters. It should all be going to digesters, as long as we're controlling for the NOx penalty.
Okay, thank you, Nick. We've got two cards, Cynthia Babbage, and then after Cynthia will be Philip Hung.
Mine's just really short, and it just has to go with what you guys were saying earlier, that a number of the letters and the oral comments aren't being captured. And so since these aren't reflected in draft documents, and since the documents are draft documents, then the ARB needs to go back and reflect the comments or explain why they're not been considered. Because as a public member, it's not okay to do that. And so those of us who have to go turn in milk bottles and everything to get our flights up here just to have our stuff shredded or misplaced or whatever, it's not okay. So could you just tell them that? I'd appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Ms. Babbage. We appreciate your comments.
And I wrote them down.
And they're on your card. They're going in your permanent record. Philip?
Hello. All right, great. I'd just like to make a couple of brief comments. It's actually something inspired by what Jesse Marquez said, and I think some things that he mentioned are definitely worth following up on, especially methyl bromide regulation. I noticed that of all the recommendations in the early action measures, whether in table 1, 2, 3, so forth, they all have to do with the 6 Kyoto gases. In order to, you know, move forward with regulating methyl bromide, whether we want to, you know, recommend it go indoors or recommend it be phased out entirely, I think it needs to be accompanied by a more general global suggestion to the ARB that they need to analyze and begin regulating post-Kyoto greenhouse gases, you know, from black carbon to particulate matter.
So Philip, actually there's a number of the measures that we recommended for early action that are all diesel measures that are black soot.
Mm-hmm.
So there's actually a huge percentage of the tonnage is from reductions in diesel emissions, just so you know, which is not a Kyoto 6 global warming pollutant, but it's a short-lived pollutant.
No, you're entirely correct, and I recognize that.
Mm-hmm.
The way we see it, the way you and I see it, Jane, is different than the way the ARB seems to see it. In their analysis, they are taking diesel as something that will produce. Their analysis of the greenhouse gas impacts are that it's, you know, unknown, and we're doing it because it has, you know, local, you know, co-benefits in terms of reducing local air pollution. But they don't acknowledge the reduction in short-term intense greenhouse gases that reducing PM and soot would take. And so there needs to be a conversation there. And the only reason, the first time I was really enlightened about it was reading something that was put out by an organization that is partly staffed by ARB. I don't remember what it was, but it was one of those flyers that you get, little pamphlets, and it talked to, you know, it was very proud of how California was leading the way, that we were, you know, cooler than the Kyoto nations, because not only were we going to regulate the 6, you know, conventional greenhouse gases, but we're going to regulate these new, you know, identified greenhouse gases that had more intense short-term impacts. And, of course, by regulating those, we really buy ourselves time over the next few years to develop the technology to take on the really big tasks. So it seems that if, you know, the ARB brass could talk to their, you know, the smart guys, the scientists on their staff, maybe we could get something done on that. And the second thing Jesse mentioned, which about the adopting flare control measures. I'd just like to say again that back in January, CBE gave comments at the January 22nd workshop calling for the adoption of flare control measures statewide. So not a statewide flare, not a state rule, but rather urging ARB to encourage the adoption of the stringent local flare control rules in air districts that have yet to do so. So we know in the Bay Area and in South Coast there are similar stringent measures. You know, for those districts, ARB we felt should increase technical support and oversight for a better enforcement of those existing flare rules. And then, of course, there are refineries in other air districts that have no such rules. And we urge the ARB to, you know, work with those air districts to adopt similarly stringent rules. So if that's something that we could just forward as a general recommendation or specific one, that's up to the committee, and I'll leave it at that.
So in general, actually, your comment about the short-term pollutants is a very important one, because there's some critics of the Kyoto Protocol that say, well, you know, we're not focusing on the things where we're focusing on reducing gases where we're not going to get a benefit for half a century. And that really we should be doing is focusing both on the Kyoto 6 and the short-lived pollutants. Because when you reduce the short-lived pollutants like PM and ozone and diesel, you get a much more immediate impact, right? It's because of their half-lives in the atmosphere are so short compared to things like, you know, the HCFCs that have a strong global warming potential and very long half-life, like a century. So I think that might be something that the early action measures don't really have. They don't look at the difference in the long-term lived gases or in the short-term lived gases. That wasn't part of any of the criteria. It wasn't part of any of the thinking behind any of the measures. It's not reflected in any of the pages in the record. So it might be a good idea for us to add it to our cover letter, mm-hmm. that we talk about this, that there is this difference, and they've got short-term and long-term pollutants, and that as we're thinking about early action measures or as we're implementing them, we need to be mindful of that there's a difference.
So, Jane, I definitely agree with your opinion on this. I think there is an implied time frame, the 100-year time frame, so that when we say, you know, when people say, you know, methane is whatever 24 times mm-hmm. more
powerful
than carbon dioxide, or the, you know, hydrofluorocarbons are X times more powerful, they're talking about over a 100-year time period. So that sort of, it's implied in such a way that it's almost it's unstated. So right. The fact that there are other pollutants out there that can have a shorter term but much more intense impact on climate change is just ignored. And so I think we do need to agree. We do need to get ARB and the Climate Action Team to address that.
Just remind the committee that when government's taking actions like we're going to extend the time frame to come into compliance with ozone standards, you're having a huge impact on global warming, right? Because ozone is a global warming gas. When you're talking about 20 new power plants in California emitting millions of pounds of PM2.5, that is a huge impact on global warming. So at the very time in which we're seeking to get reductions of these other gases, we're taking action as government and local governments to dramatically alter on this other. So, you know, there's no sort of cohesive, coherent strategy of saying we've got to reduce all this stuff right now.
and sooner. If anyone in the audience still has yet to see why we're, you know, why the committee is, you know, sort of dramatically, seems to be dramatically increasing the list of early action measures, just keep in mind that something that we start implementing by 2010 instead of 2015, by 2020, that's double the impact. You know, just draw the simple diagram and you can see, you know, you achieve double the reductions from early action measures that you would receive from something that you wait another 5 years. So,
thank you, Philip. So I've got two comments that came in over the web. One commenter is suggesting that we use incentivize rather than provide incentives in our suggestion about addressing aging power plants. I think that's probably a good suggestion. And when we do the final version of it, I think it makes sense to reflect that. It still captures the will of the committee. And a second commenter from Communities for Clean Ports says, Communities for Clean Ports wishes to thank the Global Warming Environmental Justice Advisory Committee for urging CARB to reverse its decision to leave pollution from the goods movement industry out of California's global warming legislation. We thank you for your leadership on this and reducing emissions from this monumental pollution source and for ensuring that both oral and written comments are part of this critical public decision-making process. We also express our support for the creation of thematic working groups and meetings and urge you to create a port working group as suggested by Ms. Hunter earlier this morning. We appreciate the opportunity to work with this advisory committee and thank you for your time. So, I don't think we have any more public comment or any more questions that's come in. We're at 12:45 and we're scheduled to adjourn at 1:00, and I would encourage us very, very strongly to stay to that 1:00 timeline because we've got other things planned for the afternoon. But I wanted to give the members an opportunity to make any other comments they might want to have in wrapping up the conversation about the early action measures. All right.
One of the things that if we move our list forward, I wanted to get back to that staffing question I think that Bill raised. And I had submitted or wanted to submit some comments about our group comments on the proposed staffing complement under the budget issue. And I don't know if now is the appropriate time to do that, but minimally one recommendation that could travel with this is that recognizing that we've added a number of recommendations under early action that I'm trying to find my own memo, I can't find it, but I would suggest taking some FTEs from the market advisory or the market mechanisms, putting those to early actions, taking one or more and putting them on, helping us get a handle on this information issue. I don't know why ARB can't do like CEC does. Every letter that comes in gets docketed, then the whole world has access to it. Maybe that takes additional resources, but that would be certainly time and money well spent. So when would be a good time for us to put our vision of the budget staffing complement? Is that time passed or?
Well, I think that we can certainly include those comments in our cover letter. And we had wanted to have a budget subcommittee, which I'm hoping we'll get together and meet real soon.
So we'll set a date today. So we have 10 days.
Okay. So the people that wanted to talk about the budget stuff, they get together and schedule a meeting for that. It needs to be noticed 10 days in advance because we do our meetings in public. Mm-hmm. Does that address your?
Yeah, and so I'll give those comments there. But I thought minimally maybe with this could travel.
With the cover letter,
so
yes.
We recognize there are additional resources that are needed for that.
Right. Any other final comments on early action measures?
Yeah, I've been diligently trying to craft and frame something with respect to the secondary item on the power plant conversation we had earlier with respect to the climate action team, renewables, and existing and future power plant construction.
Is it going to be an early action measure?
Well, I think it was conveyed that it might be a separate kind of recommendation, more broadly conveyed from this body to the
for the cover letter.
Right.
Okay.
So it's kind of extensive.
I think that the committee would need to hear it before we put it into the cover letter.
Okay.
Just so you know, I've got a list here in front of me of things that are going in the cover letter.
Okay. This is what it would say. It would say, EJAC recommends that all CAT agencies with jurisdiction in the area of electricity generation, procurement, siting, permitting, and renewable energy deployment conduct the following. Quantify and publicly provide the air emission impacts of new power plant construction in California and report to CARB the implications to the achievement of the state's climate and air quality goals. Two, require proponents of new power plant construction to conduct a thorough and robust renewable energy alternatives analysis. If a more carbon beneficial combination of energy producing or saving sources are available, then the utility is required to pursue that avenue. This process should begin with all currently approved and expected power plants. Three, report to CARB on the progress of existing renewable energy deployment programs and identify obstacles to the achievement of the state's renewable and climate goals. And then the fourth one would be an audit of existing and planned low-income energy consumer assistance programs for solar energy efficiency and green building programs and identify barriers that impede local community participation.
Carmona, you rock. Any comments from other committee members on that?
Is the rate setting included in your first list? The very number one, you talked about the siting and the procurement and this and that.
No, we should all.
Because the rate structures is a barrier often. So
right.
So
would that go to the fourth one or the?
That would go.
Or the first one?
Maybe the first, third, and fourth, I think. It has a role in all of those.
Okay.
So
Wherever you want to put it. Okay, so can we make a note to include that?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other comments from the committee members? I really like that, and I think that we should incorporate your suggested change, Laura, and we can include that as part of our cover letter that goes forward to ARB. Bill?
I think this is probably implied in there, Jose. I think this is a great. I'm just on that first one on the power plants. One of the issues that I know we've been trying to get included in the considerations over and over, and not just kind of not just given lip service, is cumulative impacts as part of the consideration in all of these, and I think as an Environmental Justice Advisory Committee, maybe this is a time to kind of explicitly state that in there.
And I think we need to add that part to the, when we talked about setting up a process where the committee can explore and address energy production, transmission, refineries, ports and goods movement, agriculture, cumulative impacts, economic development, and renewable energy.
Okay.
I think that we can work out logistically how the committee wants to handle those issues, and then we should, then we can talk about that at our next public meeting, how we're going to organize ourselves to do that.
Okay.
Okay, any other comments on the early action stuff? There's a hand in the audience, Jesse. Make it quick, dude. Very, very quick. Really, really, really fast and quick.
This is in relation to what Jose was just mentioning. We're talking new power plants or replacing of existing plants, but Jane had mentioned our situation in the city of Long Beach, at the port of Long Beach, where they actually were going to reopen a closed-down power plant built in 1929. They're going to pilferage five parts from old turbines to keep three of the other turbines operating. But I want to make sure that people understand what happened in the transaction, too, and that the SCE is paying NRG $300 million over 10 years, which is $30 million a year, for it to be on standby for 150 hours. So in that little assessment there, so we can
go to add repower.
So we add the repower and then the assessment of, wait a minute, is this a financially good deal? Because it's only going to cost them a million or two to operate for the 150 hours that they may operate on, and the rest is profit. I had proposed that they build some solar panel stuff there, and if not on that acreage because it's so small, build it like at Hudson Elementary School and EJ Impacted School and distribute it throughout the community. They refused to even consider it.
Okay. Thank you, Jesse. We'll add the repower. The issues around energy are myriad and growing. Any other final comments on the early action measure stuff? Okay. So we do have technically this other item on our agenda. And I know that there are people that wanted to make comments about the Market Advisory Committee. I would encourage us, especially considering that we had what I think was an important and robust conversation about the early action measures, that I'd ask the will of the committee, how do we want to handle this item? Do we still have things that we want to say, or do we want to just let it go? Laura's got a long list of things to say.
No, I have a short list of things I want to say, but first I had a question. What's the timing on their report? Is that it's not here now?
It'll be on June 1st, Friday.
So nothing happens before we get a chance to hear their presentation?
Nothing happens. They're going to release the report publicly.
That's final. We can't influence.
We are now members of the public, and once they release it, we will be able to read it, and they invite us to have whatever comments it is we have on it.
Is it released as a draft or released as a final?
It's released as a draft. They'll have a public meeting on June 12th here in Sacramento where they'll receive public comments on it, and they'll submit the completed report to ARB on the 30th of June. So if we wanted to organize ourselves, I think offline, if we wanted to organize ourselves to get together as a committee, we would need to figure out how we want to do that.
Well, I don't know how we communicate our disappointment that they want our input. What are we missing it by 2 days, 1 day? Seems like they could share.
It seems like
And I did have some specific recommendations that we might want to think about sending over there, recognizing, well, we haven't seen it, but you know, my thoughts were, one, we want them to hear from Margaret Taylor and hear what she has to say. They said they wanted to do lessons learned, but they need to hear from someone other than the cheerleaders. And second, I would suggest that they, you know, recommend that any market-based measure be tested on a proof of concept or pilot before we do it all over the state and then find out it had a fatal flaw.
Right.
So I don't know when those kinds of comments would be appropriate.
Well, we don't know what's in there, and we also don't know who they talk to because they don't do their meetings in public. So we don't know exactly who they talk to, and perhaps they have talked with Margaret Taylor. We just don't know. And we don't know what they're proposing in terms of a program, if they are proposing a small program or large program.
We just don't know.
So that brings up the issue of, you know, how does the committee want to handle this? They do have a public meeting on June 12th, and then the board is set to adopt on June 21st the early action measures. So I don't know if people want to convene another meeting to discuss the market advisory committee, or we want to just do it. We have to talk about it now. We have to set our... Okay.
Are you asking, Jane, for a meeting to actually formulate formal comments? Are you asking for us to reconvene after the report is released to develop a formal response as a committee?
I would think that the committee would want to review the report and give comment on it somehow. I don't know how we're going to do that, but I would think that we would want to definitely do that. That's the next task in front of the committee, and it would be great. Since there was a number of us that did a lot of heavy lifting on the early action stuff, it would be great if we could form a subcommittee to, you know, have the responsibility to review the report or somehow review the report.
Let me recommend that, given that it's It's about 1 o'clock, and we would need to, we can discuss the logistical issue of when we would next meet and work out a date, and then we would decide how to go forward with that.
Okay.
Because the item was agendized, we can take public comment if there are people that have things they want to say about the conversation or about the market advisory report. And just offer the last opportunity for anyone who wants to address the committee. Cynthia Babbage. Make it very, very, very fast. You turned it.
We want the report.
Thank you, Cynthia. We'll get it on Friday. Any last comments from the committee members? Then right on time, we'll adjourn the meeting. Thank you all so much. And I also would like to give special acknowledgement to our alternates who are here in the audience. They're almost all of you guys, Azubuke, Philip, Jesse is back there, Rosinda, Henry's a committee member, Erica. So thank you all so much also for being here and contributing to this. Thank you.